Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a really extensive look at a life story that honestly reads more like a tightrope walk than a career path. We're talking about Mark Moshe Kasher.
Yeah, it's quite a story.
And we're not just, you know, listing achievements here, comedian, writer, actor, host. We're diving into the sources to understand how someone with such, well, extreme contrasts in their background could even emerge.
It's a fascinating puzzle.
We've got material showing him as the child of deaf parents, actually working as a sign language interpreter by 17, growing up pretty poor in Oakland, but at the same time, in and out of mental institutions, dealing with addiction, crime.
Well, before he was even 16, right?
Exactly. So our mission today is to trace that path. How did this intense friction, you know, North Oakland poverty versus Satmar Hasidic Brooklyn, how did that forge the voice, the very specific versatile voice that launched his career? What did all that chaos actually contribute?
That's the core question, I think. Because when you look at the formal details, you see it reflected right there. Born July 6, 1979, in NYC, ends up in L.A.
Mm.
But the comedy itself, it demands that background.
How so?
Well, the genres he works in, observational, sure,
mm-hmm.
but really, he shines in black comedy, tackling those really dark, taboo subjects, and surreal humor, which, you know, kind of throws logic out the window.
Right.
And his topics are everyday life, sexuality, self-deprecation, but also religion, race, politics, heavy stuff. His whole life story basically is his source material. He's almost tailor-made to talk about these difficult things.
And the industry noticed pretty quickly, didn't they? It wasn't like a slow build.
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. 2009 was huge. iTunes named him Best New Comic. It's a major nod, basically saying, okay, this guy's got a unique, fully formed thing going on. He could somehow package that unbelievable past into jokes that worked.
That's incredible validation right out of the gate.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
And that same year, his first album, Everyone You Know Is Gonna Die, and then you are, I mean, the title tells you a lot.
Yeah, definitely sets a tone.
It hit the top 20 comedy albums on iTunes, and then Punchline Magazine called him a comic to watch in 2010. So, yeah, the momentum was there. People were ready for his kind of difficult, honest humor.
Okay, so let's dig into that foundation, that early life, because the contrasts start immediately. Born in Queens, New York, but that didn't last long.
Right. The family moved when he was just 1 year old.
To Oakland, California. Specifically North Oakland, growing up around Temescal, Piedmont Avenue neighborhoods.
And the context there is really important. The sources stress that the family was living mostly on disability assistance, food stamps.
So not an easy start financially.
Not at all. It frames that whole West Coast childhood scarcity, navigating the system, that kind of thing. It's the bedrock.
And then layered on top of that, the really defining piece, his parents were both deaf.
Yes. They met at the World Games for the Deaf back in 1967. It's a central fact of his life.
Which means he grew up not just bilingual, but bicultural in a sense. Hearing world, deaf world.
Absolutely. Think about that connection to his later comedy. He's literally a bridge between these two distinct ways of communicating, different rhythms, different rules.
And he wasn't just passively absorbing it. He became a professional interpreter.
Yeah, starting at 17, which is remarkably young.
Wow. 17. Think about that, listener. You're translating complex stuff, legal, medical, maybe really emotional conversations at that age.
It requires intense observation, understanding nuance, translating it instantly. It's like communication boot camp.
You can see how that skill set, that hypervigilance, that ability to synthesize and translate feeds directly into comedy, right? Observing life's absurdities and translating them for an audience.
Exactly. Understanding not just what's said, but how it's said, the meaning underneath. Crucial for observational comedy, crucial for black comedy. But then you layer on another massive split.
The religious one.
The religious one. His parents split when he was 9. But even before that, when Moshe was just 4, his father, Stephen, who came from secular, even communist Jewish parents, had this huge transformation.
What happened?
He became a Hasidic Jew, joined the Satmar community in Brooklyn, which is, you know, a very traditional, ultra-Orthodox group.
Wait, Satmar. So you're telling me this kid is going from, like, subsidized housing and the general vibe of North Oakland?
Yeah, pretty secular, sometimes chaotic.
To spending summers in Seagate, Brooklyn, with one of the most insular, strictly traditional, anti-secular communities out there.
Every summer. Talk about cultural whiplash. It's almost impossible to imagine navigating those two realities as a kid.
That's intense ideological friction right there. How do you even process that?
It makes you an outsider in both worlds, doesn't it?
Mm.
Satmar Hasidism is known for its separation from modern secular culture, its strict rules. So he's bouncing between an environment where maybe scarcity and street culture are realities, and one where tradition and religious law are absolute.
And this went on for years.
Until his father passed away when Kasher was 20. And we should also mention his father lived with Gaucher's disease.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a rare genetic disorder, more common among Ashkenazi Jews. So that adds another layer. Chronic illness, maybe caregiving stress, financial strain possibly, to that whole East Coast family picture.
And the family's religious ties didn't end there, right? His brother.
His brother is actually a rabbi now. So that religious structure, that lineage, it's still very present in the family, even with Moshe's very different path.
Okay, so now let's get into the period that really defined his public narrative, the stuff from his memoir, Kasher in the Rye.
Which is such a great dark title twist.
Right, and the subtitle pulls no punches. The true tale of a white boy from Oakland who became a drug addict, criminal, mental patient, and then turned 16.
It lays it all out there, and the time frame is stark, mostly between ages 12 and 16. Intense drug use, crime.
But the mental health struggle started even earlier.
According to the memoir, yeah. He talks about being moved in and out of mental institutions starting around age 4, 4 years old. That suggests a really long, difficult struggle navigating his own, internal world within these extremely challenging external circumstances.
And getting kicked out of 4 high schools. I mean, that points to just constant disruption, constant rejection. It's amazing he found a way through that.
It really is.
Yeah.
But the pivot is there. He got his GED at 16. That was the escape hatch, in a way.
A way to stop the motion.
Exactly.
Right.
And he talks about being Percy straight edge now, clean since he was very young. So that survival story, that transition from chaos to, well, relative stability in comedy, that's the engine.
And that engine, interestingly, didn't immediately drive him to the stage. It drove him to academia first.
Which makes sense, right? Mm. After all the chaos, maybe seeking structure, order, understanding, he started a community college. Studying theater.
Okay, so performance was maybe always in the back of his mind.
Possibly. Then he transferred to UC Santa Barbara. And look at what he studied. Religious studies, with a minor in Jewish studies.
Ingo, after living those extreme secular poverty versus rigid Hasidism, he goes to university to formally study the history, the philosophy, the rules of belief systems.
It's like he needed the intellectual framework to understand his own life.
Precisely. And apparently, before comedy really took over, he was seriously thinking about becoming a college professor, Jewish history.
Wow. Imagine Professor Kasher.
It's a different path, for sure. But you can still see that academic rigor, that analytical approach, in how he dissects complex social issues in his comedy now. He's not just making jokes, he's analyzing the code.
So connecting that academic detour back to performance...
Mm-hmm.
How did he actually make the jump into stand-up? It seems like quite a leap from potential professor to open mic night.
Well, the story goes, it was kind of a fateful moment in 2001. He was in New York City, went to an open mic.
Just as an audience member.
Initially, yeah. And he sees Chelsea Peretti performing.
No way.
Yep. Who he knew from junior high back in Oakland. Small world, right?
Totally. So seeing her gave him the push?
Yeah, it seems like it. He basically went up to her afterwards and said, hey, take me with you next time I want to try performing.
That takes some serious nerve.
Absolutely. Especially coming from that almost academic background. His actual first time on stage wasn't even in New York. It was back in SF at an open mic at the Luggage Store Gallery.
Okay, so he dives right in.
Dives right in. And spends the early 2000s really honing his craft in the Bay Area. He was a regular at places like the Punchline, Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco. That was his proving ground.
Developing that unique blend of, like, trauma comedy and sharp observation.
Exactly. Figuring out how to make that incredibly specific, chaotic life experience relatable and funny. Then, like many comics, he made the move to L.A. in 2008.
And then came 2009, that pivotal year we mentioned.
Yeah, that's when it really clicked on a bigger scale. Winning Best of Fest at the Aspen Rooftop Comedy Festival, that's a big deal in the industry.
And that opened doors.
Immediately. Got him invited to the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, which is huge.
Then the TV appearances started, like Comedy Central's Live at Gotham. And of course, releasing that debut album.
It all happened fast once it started moving. It really validates that he had something genuinely different to offer, right? Built from that unique past.
Completely. It was this perfect convergence of critical acclaim and audience connection, all fueled by material that was just deeply, authentically him.
Now, something else that seems really important is his writing. It wasn't just an afterthought to the stand-up.
No, definitely not. He was writing seriously quite early on. There's this long-form monologue, Look Before You Leap, that got published way back in 2003.
While he was still in college.
Yeah, in this collection called Monologues for Men by Men, Volume 2. So the instinct to shape his experiences into a narrative, a structured piece, was there early.
Interesting. Not just punchlines.
Right. And he wrote for Heat Magazine, too, in 2011, 2012. Kind of sharpening that written voice before the big one, the memoir, Casher in the Rye, came out in 2012.
Which really cemented that backstory for a wider audience.
Absolutely. That book was him taking all that personal history, the trauma, the chaos, and turning it into, well, intellectual property, artistic capital.
Huh.
He also dipped into TV writing, got a credit for an episode of The New Normal.
Called Pardon Me.
That's the one. And he's still writing. There's another memoir coming out, Subculture Vulture, a memoir in six scenes, expected in 2024. So he's clearly someone who sees himself as an author who performs, not just a comic who happened to write a book.
Okay, part three. Let's talk television presence. Because after that 2009 breakthrough, he really became a familiar face, didn't he?
Oh, for sure. He hit all the key stand-up platforms. Late Night with Jimmy Fallon twice, 2010 and 2012.
Right.
John Oliver's New York stand-up show in 2011. He did Conan, Showtime's Larry Wilmore's Race, Religion, and Sex.
That Wilmore show seems like a perfect fit, given his subject matter.
Totally. It shows he was comfortable diving into those complex social and political topics, which, again, links back to his background and his tendency towards black comedy, dissecting identity, race, faith.
And it wasn't just U.S. audiences, right? He took this stuff international.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Beyond Montreal, he played the Catlass Festival in Kilkenny, Ireland, the Melbourne Comedy Festival in Australia, plus big U.S. festivals like Fun Fest and South by Southwest in Austin.
So the humor travels. That chaos is universal.
Apparently so. Or at least the way he frames it, the family dynamics, finding your identity, questioning authority. Those themes resonate pretty widely, it seems.
And when it was time for his own solo special, he went back home.
Symbolically, yeah. Moshe Kasher, live in Oakland, recorded January 2012, released on Netflix. He filmed it at the New Parish Nightclub, right there in his hometown.
That feels significant, bringing this big career milestone back to the place where all that early struggle happened.
It's like a reclamation, isn't it? Saying, look, I came through this, and I'm bringing my success back here. It's not just telling stories about Oakland. It's celebrating in Oakland.
Beyond stand-up specials, he branched out into other TV formats, too. Hosting, acting.
Right. He was on Chelsea Lately a lot as a panelist. That was a great spot for comics with quick wits back then.
Definitely.
And then he got his own show on Comedy Central, Problematic with Moshe Kasher.
Ah, yes, Problematic. That seemed tailor-made for him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Premiered in 2017. He wrote it. He hosted it. And the whole point was tackling controversial, complex issues head-on. You really see the religious studies major coming out there wanting to foster debate, analyze the tough stuff.
Using comedy to make difficult conversations accessible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was less about just landing punchlines and more about insightful analysis. But then there's his acting, which has some surprising depth.
Like what?
Well, the standout role, the one that really brings his unique background full circle, was on Shameless.
Oh, yeah. What did he play?
He played Reuben, a character who is gay, deaf, and used a wheelchair.
Wow. So he actually used his sign language.
He did. It wasn't just, you know, learning a few lines. He could bring genuine fluency and understanding from his life as an interpreter to a complex, dramatic role on a major show.
That's incredible. It really proves that none of that background went away.
Not at all. And he's popped up in other strong roles, too.
Yeah.
Played Moshe Fefferman on Transparent. Was Duncan Traub on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, November on the League. Appeared on Drunk History, The Good Place.
So he's comfortable moving between stand-up, writing, hosting, acting. Pretty versatile.
Very. He clearly enjoys exploring different ways to perform and communicate.
Okay, so part four. Let's talk podcasts. Because Kasher didn't just dabble, he really mastered the format, exploring wildly different approaches.
Yeah, he jumped in relatively early and made a significant impact. The first big one was The Champs.
Right, starting in 2011, co-hosted with Neil Brennan.
Co-creator of Chappelle's Show, yeah.
Yeah.
And DJ Doug Pound doing sound effects and beats.
What was the vibe of that show?
Kasher himself described it as basically him and Neil hosting an hour of ridiculous chat with Doug adding sounds.
Yeah.
But it had this very specific provocative hook initially.
Which was?
Their concept was having a rotating black guy guest each week.
Oh, okay. That's bold.
Definitely bold. Very much in that black comedy vein,
pushing
boundaries around race. And they got some amazing guests because of it. Wayne Brady, David Alan Greer, Questlove.
So it was intentionally structured around that racial dynamic.
Initially, yeah. Very much leaning into uncomfortable territory, which again, feels connected to his background, his willingness to go there.
Did they stick strictly to that?
Mostly. But the sources say they occasionally strayed from its guest format.
Hmm.
Had people like Bobby Lee, Jose Canseco, Aziz Ansari on too. It clearly resonated, though LA Weekly named it Best Podcast in 2014. It ran until 2016.
So a success. What came next?
A real shift in tone and format with Houndtall Discussion Series. This premiered in 2014 on the Nerdist Network.
Houndtall. What was the concept there?
This one felt much more like the academic side of Casher coming forward. It was a live, monthly podcast focused on a single topic per episode.
Right.
And the structure was key. An hour-long chat with an actual expert on the topic, plus a panel of comedians.
Ah, interesting. So like serious knowledge meets comedic commentary.
Exactly. It's that perfect blend again.
Yeah.
Using his intellectual curiosity to guide a deep dive, but keeping it accessible and funny with the comedian panel. The first episode, for example, was about harems.
Harems. Okay.
Yeah, the expert was Jillian Lauren, who'd written about that world. And the comedians were Pete Holmes and Beth Stelling.
So the comedians kind of act like the audience, asking the dumb questions.
Pretty much. Or the absurd ones. It keeps it from getting too dry. It's a great format for learning something substantial while still being entertained. A real deep dive podcast, you could say.
Then things got more personal.
Right. In 2019, he launched the Endless Honeymoon podcast with his wife, Natasha Leggero.
Also a comedian.
Also a very funny comedian. So this podcast really reflects his current life stage, marriage, parenthood eventually. They basically turn their relationship, their issues, their dynamic into ongoing content.
That's a classic comedian move, right? Mind your own life. Must provide endless material.
You'd think so. It shows that collaborative side again, building something creative out of their personal life.
Mm-hmm.
And then most recently, bringing it truly full circle.
Back to the family.
Back to the family. In 2020, he started Casher versus Casher.
With his brother.
With his brother, Rabbi David Casher. Launched specifically during the pandemic to talk about life, faith, navigating that weird time.
Wow. So the kid balancing secular Oakland and Hasidic Brooklyn ends up co-hosting a podcast with his rabbi brother about modern life.
It's pretty remarkable, isn't it? It brings all those threads, family, religion, his Oakland roots, his Brooklyn summers, the intellectual curiosity, the comedy all together in one project.
Speaking of that personal side, let's quickly touch on those milestones in part five, because they definitely feed into his work now.
For sure. So he married Natasha Leggero in October 2015.
And she converted to Judaism, right?
Yes, that's noted in the sources.
Okay.
Which adds another layer to how that cultural and religious background continues to be part of his shared life. And then they had a baby girl in February 2018.
And that partnership, both personal and professional, led to more joint work.
It did. The big one was the Honeymoon stand-up special in 2018. It was released on Netflix, but also as a comedy album.
So they both performed.
Yeah, it was a co-headlining special, basically weaving their individual stand-up with material about their relationship, marriage, impending parenthood. It really showcases how their domestic life became central creative fuel.
Okay, and just to round things out, let's quickly list his main recorded works, his discography. It shows that evolution.
Right. Starts with the big one in 2009.
Uh-huh.
Everyone You Know Is Gonna Die. And Then You Are. That raw, edgy debut.
Then the homecoming special.
Moshe Casher. Live in Oakland from 2013. Capturing that live energy back home.
Then the collaboration.
The honeymoon stand-up special with Natasha Leggero in 2018, reflecting that partnership.
And the latest.
Crowd Surfing Volume 1 from 2020. Which sounds like it leans more into that spontaneous crowd work energy he's also known for. So you see the arc from solo trauma mining to collaborative relationship stuff to pure improv energy.
So wrapping this all up, what's the big takeaway for you, the listener, from this deep dive into Moshe Casher's life and work? When we synthesize this whole journey, it's really a story built on navigating intense, almost unresolvable contradictions, isn't it?
Absolutely. You go from that incredibly challenging youth mental health crises, addiction, poverty, institutionalization, to somehow getting a GED at 16 and then pivoting to master academic religious studies.
And crucially, he didn't just, you know, get through it. He actively used it.
He mined it intellectually. All those experiences, the poverty, the Oakland-Brooklyn split, his parents' deafness, the religious whiplash, the addiction became the fuel for this incredibly diverse media career.
The comedy isn't separate from the hardship. It's born directly out of it. Navigating deaf culture versus the hearing world, addiction versus sobriety.
Secular life versus ultra-orthodoxy.
Exactly.
His subjects, everyday life, sex, self-loathing, religion, race, politics, they aren't random picks. They're the direct result of being an outsider. Some of us an extreme outsider. In multiple conflicting systems.
It gave him that unique perspective, maybe, the ability to see the absurdity in pretty much any structure or institution, which explains the black comedy, the surreal stuff.
Definitely. And that brings us to maybe a final thought, connecting back to the very beginning. What's the real lasting impact of all that time he spent working as a sign language interpreter?
You mean on his comedy specifically?
On his whole communication style, yeah.
Yeah.
Think about what that job demands. You're not just swapping words. You're translating complex thought, emotion, cultural nuance, timing, rhythm instantly between two fundamentally different modes of communication.
It requires incredible focus and empathy.
Hypervigilance, clarity, this almost uncanny ability to read subtext and intention, working as that bridge between the deaf and hearing worlds. It's like you received this profound training in communication and observing human behavior long before you ever thought about telling a joke on stage.
So that skill, translating across cultures, translating silence into meaning, that's fundamental to his art.
I think you could argue that. It gave him this unique capacity to take complex, multi-layered ideas, whether they're intellectual or emotional or just plain absurd, and make them understandable, make them land with an audience. He learned how to make the unfamiliar resonate, how to give voice to experiences that might otherwise remain unseen or unheard. That skill, honed as a teenager bridging two worlds, might be the bedrock of his entire career as a communicator.